parents.
All right, our third and final presentation related to camelina is by Dr. Don Wysocki. He's going to talk a little bit about the impacts of fertilization on camelina.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. Had a good introduction from my two colleagues, so I may have some slides that look similar, and if I do, I'll kind of go quickly through those. I would like to acknowledge our colleagues here, Stephen and Bill and Tom and Russ and Daryl Aronson, as a colleague of ours who worked on this for 2 years, and unfortunately he passed away in the second year of this trial, but would like to recognize him for his work on this too. Stephen gave this background on camelina. It is in the brassica family. Bill's just talking about the interest in biofuels. We have little information about growing this crop, and that really was the purpose of doing all these studies, is to gain agronomic information about how we grow this crop. It is considered a low-input crop and cool and drought-resistant. This being a brassica, we do have quite a bit of information on growing brassicas like canola, but we didn't feel like we could extrapolate information from other brassicas to this one because it's quite different in how it performs and stuff. So the purpose of this study was to look at camelina by itself. The objective of this part of the study was to determine optimum nitrogen rates for camelina in those four diverse locations that appeared on some of the maps that Stephen showed, and I have a similar map: Corvallis, Pendleton, Lind, and Moscow. These are all east of the Cascade in the dryland cropping region area. Corvallis is in that high rainfall area of the Willamette Valley. So very, very contrasting growing areas. And the purpose of this was to grow this crop in very diverse cropping areas. And a little bit of information about these sites. When you're dealing with nitrogen, site and difference in rainfall really makes quite a bit of difference on what optimum levels would be. So I thought it would be good to give you a little more background on these sites. These were the soils. They're all silt loams. These soils, this is really a climosequence of soils, Ritzville, Walla Walla, and Palouse, the same lush soils that thin or vary across the Columbia Basin with rainfall. These are coarse silty, and these are fine silty soils. Elevations, you can see Moscow is considerably higher in elevation than Pendleton or Lind. Corvallis, quite low in elevation. Annual precipitation. And what I put here is growing degree days from January 1 to August 1. Try to normalize this a little bit, and you can see Moscow is quite a bit cooler. And even though Lind and Corvallis are similar, the distribution of those through the year is not the same. So even that number is the same, if you look at the distribution through the season, it's not the same. What's unique about the Pacific Northwest is our rainfall distribution. It's quite different than other areas of the country. And I just put an average precipitation for Pendleton through the crop year. We always measure crop year precipitation because we're usually growing winter crops from September to August. You can see our driest month is December. We get very little rain in September and October and June and July. We're planting this canola or this camelina about in here. Yeah, we're growing predominantly on stored water. What we did for nitrogen at these different locations, this is Lind, this is Pendleton, this is Moscow and Corvallis, we did increasing nitrogen rates. We had sulfur in this trial, in all these trials. If you look at these, the yield potential that was shown by the previous authors, Lind is a low yield potential, or the lowest. Pendleton's kind of intermediate, and these we expected to be quite high. So the nitrogen rates correspond to what we expected the yield potential to be. So here, highest rates were about 44 kilograms. Here 66, and here up to 88. For the most part, this was a randomized complete block design with four replications. These were the planting dates for the 3 years of this study at the locations. And if you look, Lynn in March, Pendleton March, Moscow's a little later, higher elevation, higher precipitation, a little later in the season. And in Corvallis, because of the slightly warmer climate, it's planting earlier. Annual precipitations, those years of the study, we'll point out, if you look at this, that's quite low. We don't have any data for this year. That was the crop failure year that Bill mentioned. So even though this was planted, there's no data for that year. These are the years. Point your attention here. This is the pre-plant nitrogen level. And this is the previous crop. Say a little bit about these pre-plant nitrogen levels. If you compare Lynn and Pendleton, these are measured by the same method. It's complete soil profile nitrogen to 4 feet in 300 millimeter increments. So we're measuring nitrate down to 4 feet at these locations. And that works fairly well in the dry growing areas. You come to Moscow and Corvallis, these numbers are in the top 1 or 2 feet of soil. Stephen's saying 2 here. This is really in the top 1 foot of soil at Corvallis. The deep nitrate is not a good indicator of nitrogen availability in these wetter environments. So we do have soil test information, but this does not work very well in the wetter environments. This seems to work fairly well in drier environments. And you notice these all followed some type of grass or cereal crop. It's an annual crop situation. A little bit about the methods. Just like Bill mentioned, we all had different drills. We all had a little different methods of application. Prior to planting, Bill used dry or liquid 32 solution sprayed on with thiosol. We use granular urea and granular ammonium sulfate for the sulfur source. Moscow, a little different, went on after planting. Had a dry granular, but thiosol is liquid. And Corvallis, again, granular materials. So sources all vary a little bit, but that's sort of what's customary. And with doing research, you do it with equipment that's available. And so that's equipment limitation, too, as well. I put this slide in just to indicate kind of the difference in yield potential of the sites. Lind, what these are is kind of the highest yield that appeared in these nitrogen trials for that year, regardless of nitrogen rate. So, you know, somewhere between 600 and 900 kilograms per hectare at Lind. We're right in that 1,700 kilograms per hectare per year. And Stephen's up here around 3,000 kilograms. And just as Stephen and Bill both indicated, Corvallis, even though high rainfall yield potentials seem lower. This particular year in Moscow, this is very late planted year, and this is a little bit atypical of the data, and you'll see that in a couple slides here. I just have to go through quickly some of the slides that I have on camelina. These are planting rate trials, so this is starting at the zero rate and just going up to the highest rates, and this is at the location of Pendleton. And this is, I believe, at the end of May. May the 28th, these were taken. And those white tubes you see there, those are neutron access tubes. They're actually measuring soil moisture on some of the treatments in this nitrogen trial. So we're just going up the rates here. That's 30 pounds of nitrogen. That's 45 with sulfur, and 60 and 75. And if you look at this stage of the game, you don't see a lot of difference in these trials. There's a little difference in bloom maturity and some other things and the visual color of the plants, but you don't see a lot of difference at this stage of the game. And I'm going to show you slides of the data at these four locations. 09 and 10, this is at Lind, and you can see if you look at Lind, there was no response to applied nitrogen. And if you remember back to the data on soil available N, those were fairly high. And so what we're seeing here is that there's probably enough residual nitrogen following our cereal crops in this low environment that there's not a lot of response to applied nitrogen both years. We come to Pendleton. There is a response, although be it a gentle response, our optimum rates usually fell right in here between this 13 and 26 kilograms per hectare would be kind of the optimum rate for a producer. These would not be cost effective to apply for the extra yield that you receive. And there's a pretty good correlation with applied nitrogen at 3 years of this study. Moscow, you had this relationship with all 3 years, and I should have taken this year out and plotted these 2 years. You can see there's a very good correlation, and there's pretty good curvilinear response in this 2010 and some even in 2009. And this shows pretty good response to applied nitrogen, and it's somewhere between 40 to 80 kilograms per hectare at these sites is the kind of the optimum level where producers would be fertilizing for camelina at that location. At Corvallis, looks something like that. There is a relationship. Because of the difficulties that some of that have been mentioned, slugs and wet conditions, the responses can be not what you expect when you get one of those unusual kind of years or you get slug attacks. You don't always get the response that you expect. But we did get a pretty good correlation at that site as well. If we look at nitrogen use efficiencies, I've sort of plotted these all together. It's kind of a busy slide, but all you have to do is look at the colors. Lind here is the black. Low rainfall, so you have low nitrogen use efficiency because we didn't get a response. There's quite a bit of residual nitrogen for this crop at that site. Pendleton, you go to a little higher rainfall site, you increase nitrogen use efficiency, and if you go to Moscow, which is green here, you have much greater nitrogen use efficiency for the increments of nitrogen applied, and that applies for Corvallis as well in this one particular year. So these are all the years, but I didn't separate out the year or indicate the difference of the years here, just the location is the color. And just a summary. At Lind, we didn't get a response to applied N. Residual N seems sufficient for the crop. Camelina responded at Pendleton, optimum rate somewhere between 13 and that should be 26. That's an error right there. The residual was insufficient, and you know, what I see is about 4 kilograms per 100 kilograms of expected grain yield would be kind of what our fertilizer guide would come out to be. And at Moscow and Corvallis, somewhere between 44 and 88 kilograms per hectare is optimum, excluding that year, a poor year at Moscow in 2008. Soil N was less of a factor at Corvallis because of the wet environment. And that'd be the conclusion. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Yeah. Hold the questions just a second. Is Maria Rossi in the room? No? Well, then we have time for quite a few questions.
And okay.
And I sense there is some interest in this. I know that the U.S. Navy is really interested in this particular crop. They seem to be one of the greenest parts of the United States military, and there is a huge interest. And with that, let me open it up to questions pertaining to your presentation, and then just some general comments.
Yeah, right up right in front here. Okay, the question is about downy mildew. And there was significant downy mildew in Corvallis. We did observe downy mildew in two out of 3 years at Pendleton, but it was about 1 to 2% of the plants. So in that case, I would say that was insignificant. Stephen, I'm not sure what impact you had at.
This year was the first year we saw any significant downy mildew at all. It was a very cool, wet year for us.
And Bill's fortunate, he's so dry, he doesn't get that at all. Yes, ma'am.
Did you see any increased lodging with higher end rates?
Question is, did we see any increased lodging with higher end rates? We did not at Pendleton, and I think my colleagues would say they did not either at the other locations. When we did get lodging, Stephen showed that one slide, and we had an intense thunderstorm, so they all lodged together. Yes, sir.
Any concern that it might escape and become a pest?
We don't have that concern in these cropping systems because of the cereal cropping systems. So the following crops, generally the herbicides that are used on wheat, would typically take care of that. And Stephen did mention that a lot of the residual herbicides that use a lot of our acres, if we wanted to grow this crop, they're going to have to rotate out of some of these residual herbicides if we want to have very significant acres of these, because we do use those, some of those long residual herbicides. Stephen's got a question or an answer here too, I think. Right here. And there are no registered materials other than post. So experimentally we could do it, but our growers couldn't do it. Yes, sir. Any potential for Sonalin? I think there would be. It'd have to be approach a registrant and get it registered. If camelina becomes a major crop, I would see that happening. There's been quite a bit of weed scientists have been doing quite a bit of work with different herbicides. I know in Montana they have, and Carol Mallory Smith at Corvallis is doing some work on that as well. Yes, sir.
I've seen emergency problems what problems have you seen in this?
The question is about emergence problems, and I think this would be one of the challenges to growers. This crop was touted by some people in Northwest that you can just throw it out and it grows. And I think that's incorrect, is you have to pay attention. You want it to seed it shallow, quarter inch or less, but uniformly. And so how you prepare your field and what kind of drills you use will influence that. What you don't want is some of your seed 1 inch deep and some right at the surface, because anything deeper than 3/4 or 1/2 inch isn't going to come up. So, you have to be careful about seed placement. And where I've seen failures, it's either because it's too wet or there's been irregularities in seed depth and rough seed beds. So, there is some agronomy that you have to apply to this. No. Bill planted this direct seed. I planted his direct seed. Bill mentioned some of the growers, innovative growers, they're planting direct seed. So it's really that seed placement that becomes the issue. If you have the right tool and do this during the right period of time, you can do this successfully, 10 out of 10 years. But At Pendleton, I would say that our most successful seedings were early March, and that's because we could glyphosate in front of it and direct seed right in there. You controlled all your winter annual grasses and weeds. The springs have not come yet. You plant the camelina at just at the right stage, and in Pendleton in March, it's, you know, we're still getting rain, so you get rain on the crop, it comes up, and it's competitive. So it's just understanding your cropping system and how to fit it in, and then having the right tool to do it. Yes, sir. It would be both. I've seen both methods used. Some of the growers I know they're doing this are using those air seeders, just like Bill showed, some kind of air seeder with a hole opener and just, you know, blowing that on the surface, some of the seed on the surface, or just slightly scratching the surface. Some have broadcast it with their drills and harrowed behind it. There's a variety of those kind of practices, but the objective is the same, is to get it seeded shallow uniformly so it comes up quickly, and then, you know, it's a function of the tool that you have, you know.
Right. So most of your growers out there have large drills to do small seeded crops?
Well, those air drills would. If you have conventional drills, that may be more difficult depending what kind of feed cups that you have and what drills you have. Getting down to that small amount. What we have done is, put filler like rice hulls or something else in there. So if you have those kind of drills, you can bulk that up with the filler and get those low rates. Now that's just a wide air distribution frame that blows it out. Yes, sir.
Yeah, there's been talk about poor emergence. Could some of that poor emergence just be due to the seeding too shallow and the dry soil?
Yes. Well, and if you noted in Bill's data, if you look at some of those later seeding days, especially at Lynn where he broadcast, is laying on the surface, and, you know, Lynn's just too dry to broadcast on those later seeding dates. So, yeah, that drying out could be an issue. So it's knowing your conditions and hitting the optimum seeding dates. You know.
It's just like every other crop needs to have available moisture to germinate. But if you can't back the crop and come back tomorrow and see it start to germinate. So it doesn't take long for that moisture to be there to get it started.
I'm in Minnesota. I typically see a little bit deeper than that because I found that, you know, you've got some slot for camelina. I mean, it's pretty hard for them to come up from quite a ways down.
Really? We have not had at all.
Oh, really?
We get in trouble with that. No more than that.
Yeah, in fact, we did a plant rate by depth study this spring. I had camelina coming up from an inch. And we're at a soapy ball.
Does your soil crust?
Yeah, we don't have as probably a crusty problem as you might have.
Yeah, so you're blessed in Minnesota, that's all. So.
Well, we have the cold.
Yes, ma'am.
Did you guys look at oil content then relative to yield, and did that change particularly with the fertility?
I just got that data last week, so I haven't had time to analyze that. So we did look at oil data, but it wasn't available for this presentation. But if you want, I will, you know, give me your card or your address, and I'll be happy to share that with you. Yes, sir. Okay, that's a fair question. He's asking about the yield potential difference between winter canola and camelina. In these very dry areas, our most difficult problem is getting those canolas established. And if you go by conditions, maybe 1 in 10 years will you get a fall canola established. So even though you have higher yield potential, you can't get it established, and growers aren't going to grow it if you can't get it established. In the spring condition, these at our location, and I think at Stevens, these were out yielding spring planted canolas. So if you could get fall canola established, that would be great, but we just can't do that. Now, in the Willamette Valley, that may be a different story, but there's some other issues there that winter canola is not grown there. There's one more question back there.
You mentioned you also had sulfur.
Oh, okay, yeah, I meant to say that in the presentation. We had no response to sulfur, but in all fairness, all our sites tested high to sulfur soil test as well. So we didn't have a response, but we had high soil tests.
Gentlemen, thank you for an excellent overview of this up-and-coming crop. Very much appreciated.